The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for the civilians killed in its airstrikes. The United States has failed to provide an accurate tally of equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen to the wrong hands.
So the United States, by picking up this banner that the United Kingdom, the British Empire, left, has basically realized the most effective way to combat any sort of rise of anti-imperialism or any sort of self-determination for these colonized, these exploited countries, is by, instead of just launching a full-out invasion of U.S. forces, that the intelligence agencies should begin covertly funding and fostering organizations that will have inner conflict between the main group, in the case of Mau Mau, by supporting a counter game.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa is the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and his personal life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the personal life of Imam Khomeini, the aspect of his personal life. What we can see is that Imam Khomeini was performing all his things by himself. Even if he wanted a glass of water, he used to take water by himself. He never asked it from his wife or the children. So he used to do everything by himself. And his family, they said that even if he wanted a cup of tea, he used to go and make tea for himself and used to bring tea for us as well. Therefore, he was very much bound to the level that if he can perform anything by his hands or himself, he used to do it without asking others, and without disturbing others. And he wasn't a person who used to order people in the house. He used to do it by himself. Therefore, his children have said that we haven't seen our father ordering us to, for example, bring water, do this, do that. No, not like this. He wasn't like this. He was a person who was very much humble, who was very much bound to the Islamic teachings, who was very much loving, and he used to take care of everyone in the house. And this was how Imam Khomeini, in his personal life, when we look at his life within the house, he was very much caring and loving person.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the personal aspect of the life of Imam Khomeini, and we said that he used to perform everything by himself, and he never asked others to do the things which he wanted. So his own works, he used to do it. And we can see that, for example, Hajj Mustafa, his son, he said that, "I never saw my father ordering me." And even once I remember that once he needed a pen and paper, and it was on the second floor. So when he wanted it, he searched for it and he couldn't find it. And he asked me, "Where is the pen and paper?" I said, "It is on the second floor." Therefore, he went up by himself and brought it without asking me to go up and bring it. Therefore, his son says, "I never remember that he has ordered me." On the other hand, we have other stories about his life where he went to the ziyarah of Imam Rada alayhi salam in Mashhad, where they were staying at a hotel, and the companions of Imam, they said, they asked him to go for the ziyarat when they reached after they had the dinner and the tea. So Imam Khomeini has said them, like, "You guys should go. I need to rest, for I need some rest, and I will visit the shrine later." So the companions, they went, and when they came back, they saw that Imam Khomeini by himself has washed all the dishes, and he had prepared or made tea for his companions or the friends. When they came back, he served them with that tea. And this shows us that he was very much concerned about his personal life, about the people who were around him, so that they are not feeling any hardship because of him at that point. And this is a lesson to learn, that we should also apply these things in our life if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allah, 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 Allah. Inna alladhina qalu rabbuna Allah thumma istaqamu. Allah, Allah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The
limelight. Because the Zionist regime has no way to justify its crimes against Palestinians, and apartheid is one of the most serious crimes against humanity there is, smearing critics as Jews haters is the last weapon in Israeli regime's propaganda arsenal, says Michael F. Roundrider in an article titled, "The Zionist regime's smears against Amnesty fail to hide apartheid." Stay tuned for more. Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a pro-Israeli regime group, slammed Amnesty International's new report on the Zionist regime's apartheid as anti-Semitic. No surprise there. He was echoing the line pushed by the Zionist regime and its lobby for days. The Wawitz organization has worked closely with the Zionist regime's covert efforts to smear its critics around the world. It's worth highlighting that the Wawitz attempt to use the International Remembrance Alliance's so-called identification of anti-Semitism to claim that fact-based criticism of the Zionist regime policy equals anti-Jewish hatred. The Wawitz tweeted recently that Amnesty is anti-Semitic. Their slurs against the Jewish state meet the internationally recognized IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, he claimed. The IHRA definition, promoted by the Zionist regime and its lobby groups, conflates criticism of the Zionist regime and its ideology, Zionism, on the one hand, with anti-Jewish bigotry on the other hand. It has become one of the main tools of censorship in the handful of Western regimes where it has been adopted. Because the Zionist regime has no way to justify its crimes against Palestinians, and apartheid is one of the most serious crimes against humanity there is, smearing critics as Jew haters is the last weapon in the Zionist regime's propaganda arsenal. Lara Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, critiqued Dubowitz's framing. Friedman tweeted, Amnesty's new report is a great opportunity for opponents of criticism of Israel to illustrate that, indeed, delegitimizing factual criticism of Israel is, in fact, the real objective of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. The Zionist regime officials led with a heavy-handed approach before the publication, trying to get out ahead of the report. Their alarm is understandable. Amnesty is perhaps the world's best-known human rights group. With chapters in dozens of countries, it has not merely launched a report about the Zionist regime apartheid, but a global campaign to end it. The group has put a lot of effort into presenting its findings in a clear and accessible way. The Zionist regime simply cannot overcome the mountain of evidence, so all it can do is attack the messenger. Foreign Minister Yair Lapid predictably called Amnesty's report false, biased, and anti-Semitic, a line that has been echoed by many other officials and lobby groups. But in the end, their false claims only served to further publicize Amnesty's report and broaden the discussion about how the fake regime of Israel perpetrates apartheid. At the State Department's press briefing recently, the AP's Matt Lee called out the spokesperson Ned Price for the U.S. double standard for frequently accepting Amnesty's positions on other human rights concerns, but rejecting the group's analysis when it comes to the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights. Price had earlier stated that we reject the view that Israel's actions constitute apartheid. Asked about the Zionist regime officials terming the report anti-Semitic, Price did object, saying, "We certainly reject the label that has been attached to this." But in the next breath, he reverted to IHRA language, suggesting that criticizing the Zionist regime, which receives billions of dollars of weapons from Washington every year, could well constitute a double standard and therefore indicate bigotry. He leaves Palestinians and equal rights for them out of the equation. Once more, anti-Palestinian racism is clear. We think that it is important, as the world's only Jewish state, and the Jewish people must not be denied the right to self-determination, and we must ensure there is a double standard being applied, unquote. Tom Knight, the U.S. ambassador to the occupied territories, didn't try to weaponize the anti-Semitism charge. He attempts simply to dismiss the Amnesty report as if it were self-evidently ridiculous. He tweeted, "Come on, this is absurd. That is not language that we have used and will not use." Knight said nothing about Amnesty becoming the third major rights group to release a report concluding that the Zionist regime commits the crime of apartheid since the election of President Joe Biden. Those groups and the many Palestinians who have for decades shown how the Zionist regime perpetrates apartheid are not voices the U.S. ambassador is open to hearing. But this colleague, John Kerry, currently the U.S. climate envoy, did raise the Zionist regime's apartheid at least as a future possibility back when he was U.S. Secretary of State during the Obama administration. At the time, commentator Philip Weiss asked, how long are you allowed to issue dire predictions of future apartheid when there have been two sets of laws for different ethnicities under the Zionist regime sovereignty for 47 years of occupation? Three major reports later, and U.S. officials still refuse to grapple with the grim reality. There is no other conclusion than that anti-Palestinian racists head the Democratic and Republican political parties. 1 month they laud Bishop Desmond Tutu following his death, and then the next day dismiss charges of the Zionist regime apartheid as absurd and fail to take to heart Tutu's own observations about the Zionist regime. American politicians offered a variety of reactions, including one from congressional candidate Wade Aroff, a co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement. Unsurprisingly, the deniers of the apartheid really were also out in force. And tennis superstar Martina Navratilova challenged Congresswoman Chantal Brown, a Democrat, over her denial of the apartheid reality. The New York Times, for its part, had simply ignored Amnesty's report. The BBC website did carry an article about Amnesty's report giving the Zionist regime foreign minister Lapid the last word to smear it. But like the New York Times, the BBC's flagship News at 10 program omitted mention of the Amnesty report, though it did have a space for a story on Wurl, the viral internet puzzle. Of course, apartheid doesn't fit the five-letter limit on that word game. Nor does censor. The Washington Post, by contrast, ran quite a good piece, and journalist Miriam Berger made sure to note that Palestinians have been making the case that this is apartheid for far longer than Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. Berger wrote, Palestinians have long used the language of apartheid to describe Israel's system of governance since the country's founding following the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, during which some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were expelled from their homes, and the military occupation of the West Bank, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip in 1967. Although the Zionist regime and its supporters are pushing back hard, their smears and deflections are failing to hide that the fabricated regime of Israel is an apartheid regime.
We congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
In the name of God, salam, all the listeners, everyone who's listening to us from all around the world, dear sisters and brothers, we are with you. Here is IRB English Radio. We're having another session of the Youth Station.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Today we're having some interesting topics for you as well.
Yeah, choo choo ka choo, it's the youth station for you. You were waiting
yes,
for it, right?
Yes, of course. And there's no start with that, choo choo ka choo. Here with us, we have.
Muzaffar Haider.
Yes, we have our brother Muzaffar.
I wanted to start with a story.
I love stories.
Yeah, so I have a potentially very upbeat, friendly, happy personality.
That's very good.
Potentially.
Potentially.
Because a lot of the times what I've noticed is what happens is when I go into certain environments with that attitude, there'll always be one person who kind of pokes at it. Yeah.
That's too bad.
And when they poke
yes,
at it
happens.
It makes you go, oh, okay, and then it makes
like
you retreat.
They crush you.
Yeah, it makes you retreat.
Hold back.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you find yourself in a different environment where you feel like, oh, I need to be a bit quiet here.
Yes.
When I was supposed to be like really loud and friendly. There was one guy, he was really nice, like really nice guy, and he was just friendly, open, like speaking openly, making jokes all the time. And for some reason, I made a snide comment about him.
So,
you know, I kind of said, oh, yeah, something nasty about him.
So it happens to all of us, perhaps.
It's really bad, but that helped me to realize the mentality of somebody. Because I was shy, because I was afraid of being like him,
that's
felt
one of the reasons.
Some weird desire to kind of bring him down. It's shaitan. I'm telling you, sister, it's shaitan.
Yes, true.
Shaitan could never have the strength to be like Adam.
Yes.
Right? And so, because he was not the chosen one, he wanted to bring the chosen one down.
Exactly.
This is
the
really
comparison
devilish.
He made. We sometimes do the mistake of insulting other peoples or drag them down to our level. And we said that there might be some personal issues behind that. But then sometimes some people trigger you into a point where you are irritated.
I get triggered so easily.
I can't say that I am very patient and I do not do anything, but most of the times when I'm too angry, I quit talking.
Uh-huh. You just go quiet.
Yes, that's a personal thing that happens every time. When I'm too angry and too desperate with the situation, I don't talk.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a good thing, to be honest.
Yes, that's a good thing, but sometimes it kills me from the inside because I want to explode, but there is not such a ability in me.
The explosive people are not the ones, apparently, that psychologists say you should be worried about. It's implosive people who are dangerous because they're quiet, and then they turn up at a shopping center with a gun and then shoot everybody.
No, but I'm not so dangerous. Don't worry.
Okay. But yeah, Islam, you won't believe this, but no, you will believe it. But Islam actually teaches us to get angry.
To get angry?
To get angry, yeah.
Why? Yeah. No, there's no way.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, never.
Because it says in the Quran, idfa billati hiya ahsan, kind of defend yourself, crudely translated here.
Yes.
Defend yourself or fight back by that which is ahsan, that which is best. Okay, and it's the context is about, you know, when people...
Which is very difficult at the moment.
Exactly, because the next verse actually says that. It says it is only those who have a lot of patience can accomplish this.
Yes, again, the story of patience, which is the most difficult job.
So the idea is that one of the worst things we can do when somebody has insulted us or when somebody's done something that's made us angry is actually just to take it and I'm going to bear this patiently and let it just go inside. It's actually one of the worst things we can do. And by the way, I just want to point out, this is just my opinion. If you disagree, please do go ahead.
Yes.
I feel that what we need to do or learn to do is to respond, but in the best way.
That best way, the part that you're saying, the best way, changes the story upside down.
That changes the entire story, right?
Yes.
It's like, you know, are you not
making...
You need
to be very patient.
Yeah.
And very much evolved. You should be such a person who has been developed through many years.
Yes and no. You can learn to do it at a younger age. I mean, I don't do it. I'm just saying I don't do it.
Yes.
I know how it can be done.
I know what you
mean.
That's
what's really frustrating about it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Like, okay, give me an example of an insult. I'll show you how to do it. You've done English literature. You can do an insult, trust me. When somebody throws you a ball, you catch the ball and you throw it back.
In a nice way.
And you can do it in the nicest of ways.
Yes.
I'll give you another example, right? Imam alayhi salam. I think it was the sixth imam, seventh imam. It was Imam Baqir. It was the fifth imam.
Yes.
Alayhi salam. He's plowing the field, right?
Yes.
The imams were constantly engaged in some sort of hard labor. A man comes to him and he says, Baqir, which means cow.
Yes.
Hey, Baqir, right? He insulted him because his name was Baqir.
Yes.
Imam Baqir doesn't just, you know, be silent and bear it. No, he says, my name is Baqir. It's not Baqir.
That's patient.
You know, but he replied.
Yes,
you know,
he replied.
He gave that response rather than just remaining silent. The man takes another step. He insults the imam's mother, blessed mother. And he says that, you know, your mother was a such and such woman. She was a cook, you know, because Imam Baqir's mother used to cook food.
Yes, right?
And that was how she served the cause of Islam. Imam Baqir simply said, well, you know what? That's a profession and there's no... you know, there's no shame in it, such a profession.
There is no shame.
Then he says, you know, he said a very, very bad insult to the blessed imam's mother. At this point, the imam turns around and he says, if what you say is true, may Allah forgive my mother. And if say is untrue, may Allah forgive you.
Yes.
You see, this is what I mean. You take the ball that is given to you and you give it back.
What a heritage we have.
Right?
Yes.
And I can't think of practical examples, but I know that I've done this before, and I'm sure that you've done it before as well, and it probably made you feel really good.
It doesn't come right now.
It gives you power.
Yes, it gives.
It gives you a sense of power in the society, in the social environments, and we really need to develop that
power. I think by time, as we grow up, we'll learn it. We'll learn how to deal with such people.
If we practice it.
Except from sometimes when we are so... tired, or maybe we ourselves have problems, so we can't just reply in a nice way.
Yeah, yeah.
We're human beings, you know, everything is possible.
Sometimes, though, I would say that you do just need to get angry. It's a good thing to get angry, especially if some sort of injustice has taken place. Remember,
exactly. Injustice, yes.
Yeah, all of the ahadith which are talking about, you know, patience, not losing your temper, they're not talking about when injustice has taken place.
Yes.
In fact, you know, you have to get angry. Islam tells you that you need to get angry when injustice takes place. So
of
I think
course,
that's one thing that
we overlook. Of course, you have to stay for your own rights.
Yeah.
Or even other people.
Yeah, if somebody's trampling on you and you're going to be like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not Christians, right?
Yes.
Our religion is not, you know, turn the other cheek. No.
Yes.
Our religion says that if somebody slaps you, slap them back so that you stop that slapping
and,
from taking place.
A question comes here. What about a moment where another person is insulted in front of you? Do you take any action?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes that's easier to take action, isn't it? You should... always defend that person.
Sometimes it is difficult.
Sometimes, yeah, it's very difficult, especially...
because you're in a crowd and it is very difficult, even if it is injustice and you have to speak. But I don't know why you keep silent. And you know that that person is being oppressed.
Yeah.
But because there are plenty of people in there, you're scared perhaps of the crowd.
That's the cool thing about Islam, right? It frees you from any kind of fears. You're supposed to have this kind of fearless attitude.
Yes, you should be brave.
Yeah. Yeah, Islam makes you brave. It forces you to be brave a lot of the time.
Exactly. So we talked about insulting, being insulted, being irritated by the one who insults you and the other people. And also we said that there's some ways to get out of that insulting thing.
This is all about this kind of sense of honor. I want to be better than this person, and therefore you will insult this person.
Yes, we
talked about somebody's insulting you, it's because you're in the limelight. It's because they see you as a kind of threat to their own honor. They want to be above you in some way, right?
Yes, exactly.
So the Quran says, "Man kana yuridu al-izzata falillahi izzatu jami'a." One who desires honor, honor is entirely Allah's.
Yes, it's
sometimes when somebody insults you, especially in a public gathering, like with others around, and you just kind of don't say anything and you just put your head down,
yes,
it backfires against them. Because everybody sees that that person is just insulted, and it actually damages their own reputation.
Yes,
and you look quite graceful.
Because everyone is noticing that situation.
I think there's a hadith that says that if somebody says something that you don't like, or they attack you verbally, lower your gaze, like just look down, and it will go over your head. It will miss you.
That's very true. Yeah.
You know, so sometimes that's the solution.
Ignoring is sometimes a system as well on its own. You can ignore, and then I think everybody would notice that you're more intellectual than they are because you didn't drag yourself down into their level.
Yeah. Sometimes you're dealing with a particularly obnoxious person, like a person who is constantly doing something.
Those people are very much vivid. I mean, everyone knows that they are like this. So I think everyone ignores them, except those who have the heart and the God.
But what if you're stuck with such a person? You're having to work with such a person. But sometimes you're in the workplace or the education sphere, you know.
A co-worker, a classmate, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Well,
so
there's no way. One day you'll explode in their face.
Yeah, so isn't it better to just let those explosions out at short bursts? Rather than build it all up and then come in one day with a gun and just like bazooka them.
Yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. But in its practice, I have to practice more.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to stay for our own rights. I told you, most of the time I thought ignoring those people is a good strategy. But at some point I learned that, no, sometimes you have to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more you stay silent, the more people is going to think what you, the way you are being treated is the true way.
Yeah.
So you have to speak. So thank you for listening to us. This was all we could give you of the topic we talked about. Hope you're not tired and you enjoyed it all. Thank you. And until another session with Youth Station, may God be always on your side.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, I will when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love, my
in the limelight.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist, in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. '21 was another banner year for the military-industrial complex as U.S. Congress signed off on a new record $778 billion in spending for the Pentagon and related work on nuclear warheads at the Department of Energy. That was $25 billion more than the Pentagon had even asked for. It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on a Pentagon. That department's astronomical budget adds up, for instance, to more than four times the cost of the most recent version of Biden's Build Back Better plan, which sparked such horrified opposition from Senator Joe Manchin and other alleged fiscal conservatives. Naturally, they didn't blink when it came to lavishing ever more taxpayer dollars on the military-industrial complex. Opposing Build Back Better while throwing so much more money at the Pentagon marks the ultimate in budgetary and national security hypocrisy. The Congressional Budget Office has determined that if current trends continue, the Pentagon could receive a monumental $7.3 trillion plus over the next decade, more than was spent during the peak decade of the Afghan and Iraq wars, when there were up to 190,000 American troops in those countries alone. Sadly, all too periodically, Biden's decision to withdraw U.S. troops and contractors from Afghanistan hasn't generated even the slightest peace dividend. Instead, any savings from that war are already being plowed into programs to counter China, official Washington's budget-justifying threat of choice. And all of this despite the fact that the United States already spends three times as much as China on its military. The Pentagon budget is not only gargantuan, but replete with waste, from vast overcharges for spare parts to weapons that don't work at unaffordable prices to forever wars with immense human and economic consequences. Simply put, the current level of Pentagon spending is both unnecessary and irrational. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excesses of the Reagan military build-up. Such pricing horror stories didn't emerge from thin air. They came from the work of people like legendary Pentagon whistleblower Ernest Fitzgerald. He initially made his mark by exposing the Air Force's efforts to hide billions in cost overruns on Lockheed's massive C-5A transport plane. At the time, he was described by former Air Force Secretary Warren Orr as the most hated man in the Air Force. Fitzgerald and other Pentagon insiders became sources for Dina Racer, a young journalist who began drawing the attention of the media and congressional representatives to spare parts over charges and other military horrors. In the end, she formed an organization, the Project on Military Procurement, to investigate and expose waste, fraud, and abuse. It would later evolve into the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, the most effective current watchdog when it comes to Pentagon spending. A recent POGO analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of Transdigm, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%. Yes, you read that figure right. On routine items. The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons they don't need at prices they can't afford, systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance the safety and security of Americans. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating those planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of F-35 was to build a plane that, in several variations, would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at POGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. And its failures are too numerous to recount here. But a few examples should suffice to suggest why the program minimally needs to be scaled back in a major way, if not canceled completely. For a start, though meant to provide air support for troops on the ground, is proved anything but well designed to do so. In fact, that job is already handled far better and more cheaply by existing A-10 Warthog attack aircraft. A 2021 Pentagon assessment of the F-35, and keep in mind that this is the Department of Defense, not same outside expert, found 800 unresolved defects in the plane. Typical of its never-ending problems, a widely expensive and not particularly functional high-tech helmet, which at a cost of $400,000 each, is meant to give its pilot a special awareness of what's happening around and below the plane as well as to the horizon. And don't forget that the F-35 will be staggeringly expensive to maintain and already cost an impressive $38,000 an hour to fly.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa, 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 whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. The refusal to surrender to an arrogant enemy is another principle of the revolution. One should not tolerate the enemy's aggression. It is one thing to negotiate, for example, with the enemy, but it is quite another thing to interact and cooperate with them. The revolution says that we should not surrender to the aggression and unreasonable demands of the enemy. We have not surrendered up until now, and we will not surrender from now on either. This is one of the principles. But they are attempting to undermine this by saying, what's wrong with that? What's the problem? In other words, they wish to undermine such an outstanding principle. Other principles of the revolution include the independence of the country and fighting corruption, injustice, and the like. These are parts of the vast, diverse, soft war which is pursued by the enemy. We should pay attention to these points and prevent the elimination of this sensitivity. Intellectuals, writers, speakers, those who pursue various social activities, those who are active in the internet, and those who have various capabilities are responsible in this regard.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They should not allow the enemies to gradually undermine the sensitivity and zeal of the people. We must realize that the idea that these principles are not beneficial for the people, for the country, and for the future is a very wrong idea. It is pure injustice. Over the past 43 years in our country, whenever we have made progress, whenever we have made a successful move, and whenever we have had resources at our disposal, it was because we had revolutionary people who entered the field with high morale and diligence, who worked hard. As a result of this, we have made progress. Whenever pious, revolutionary, well-informed, competent individuals entered scientific, industrial, technical, and political areas, we have been able to make progress. And when we look at why a task in hand did not move forward, we see that it was because of opportunism, corruption, and aristocratic, non-revolutionary outlooks and moves. These things cause the tasks in hand to not be worked on and to stop moving forward. Therefore, commitment to the principles of the revolution is surely one of the most important means for the progress of the country and the nation. This is another point that you should pay attention to. The next point, which in my opinion is very important, is the issue of preserving unity in the country. We must reduce the factors that create discord as much as we can. Of course, there are differences in opinion, viewpoints, methods, and mentalities. These things exist, but we should not let them lead to taking stances against one another.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it. Others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted, but the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel. And that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pourreza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelly, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of the national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of the public sphere. And so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players